and welcome to The Huntington Way. My name is Pearl Sonnenschein.
And I'm Lenny DiCastro.
And in today's episode, we'll be talking about populations of students that are considered at risk and the programs in place in and outside of schools that support these students.
Let's clarify the meaning of at risk. At risk is defined as students that are at higher risk of failing out of school. There is a large number of factors that people attribute at risk to. Socioeconomic status, incarceration, health issues, teenage pregnancy, factors related to home life, such as homelessness or domestic violence.
There are also factors such as disciplinary problems, grade retention, low test scores, learning disabilities, and limited English proficiency that contribute to at-risk students as well. The list really goes on, which is what sometimes makes at-risk students difficult to identify because the term is so broad.
Let's go talk about some statistics. Here are some Colorado statistics related to at-risk populations. 12% of students in Colorado fall under special education. 25% of students in Colorado fall under Title I. That is one-fourth of our student population in the state. During the year of 2021, graduation rate for the state of Colorado is 81.7%, which falls below the 86% graduation rate of the United States. The 2021 dropout rate in Colorado was 1.8% compared to the U.S. average of 6%.
While there are startling numbers and statistics behind this population of students, the somewhat good news is that there are programs that are put in place that support students in hopes that they will graduate. First is something that Lenny just mentioned, which is Title I. Title I is a federally funded program that provides financial assistance to school districts based on the number of low-income students enrolled. The goal of this grant, along with Titles II through VII, is to help ensure that economically disadvantaged children still receive as high-quality education as possible by closing academic achievement gaps.
Another way of supporting at-risk students is through IEPs and 504 plans. This is for students with disabilities, with learning or otherwise. Let's go define IEP. IEP stands for an Individualized Education Plan. Students with more severe disabilities, such as autism, cerebral palsy, speech difficulties, and the like, often have an IEP. It outlines accommodations, modifications, supports, and services that the students in special education needs in order to be successful in school. Created by an IEP team that includes the child's parents, at least one general education teacher, at least one special education teacher, a school psychologist, and a district representative.
504 plans are for students that may have a somewhat less severe disability that would not qualify them for an IEP, and some of those might include ADHD, ADD, anxiety, depression, or dyslexia. 504 plans are similar in that they are a blueprint for a student's needs in order to be successful in the classroom, and they are also a legal document, but they are less detailed documents that do not have as many requirements as an IEP.
Both of these plans help students with disabilities achieve academic success along with their peers.
Just to name a few more ways schools support at-risk students, there is MTSS, and different schools have different acronyms for this, but MTSS stands for Multi-Tiered Systems of Support, and this is a program for students who are not in special education but still need that extra help and support outside of the classroom. What these environments look like often is blended learning, where there is a mix of in-person classes and maybe online learning that is self-paced. And there's also a teacher that is an advocate for students to help students get their work done and also to serve as an advocate for these students who may not have someone like that in their home life. There are also reading and math intervention classes and intervention teachers available. And then, of course, we can't forget about counseling services that are offered in schools. Counselors can help create 504 plans for families and help with a variety of emotional needs for students.
There are many other ways that schools work to support their students. And these programs depend on the district and the population of students that are enrolled. Outside of school, there are still ways at-risk children can get help.
There are many after-school programs available for students, such as the YMCA, Boys and Girls Clubs, Big Brother, Big Sister, or programs held at your local library. One challenge that many families face, particularly low-income families, is the ability to have their children participate in these after-school programs due to parents not being able to bring them to these certain activities. The best and easy ways to support disadvantaged students is to build a strong relationship with them.
One of the best and easy ways to support disadvantaged students is to build a strong relationship with them. If students have a trusted adult they can go to, it makes a world of difference. Along similar lines, if the trusted adults model self-advocacy for the student, that can also help. It's one thing to tell a student to self-advocate. It's another thing to show the student how to advocate for themselves.
In a little bit, I'll be interviewing Dr. Margaret B. Wright, someone with a plethora of experience in the field of education and counseling. But first, our weekly tip for parents.
This week's tip is, if your child is on IEP or 504, encourage them to remind their teachers of their accommodations.
We've already said that it's important for students to learn to self-advocate, but it's even more important for students with accommodations to receive that extra help. I know it can be hard for students to tell their teacher that they need extra time on a test or multiple breaks throughout the block, but having these lines of communication between the student and the teacher will benefit parties immensely.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, Pearl is going to interview Dr. Wright to hear about her efforts in supporting disenfranchised students, so stay tuned.
Welcome back. I am here with Dr. Margaret B. Wright, an educator, counselor, author, and president and CEO of the organization Collaborative Educational Supportive Services. So welcome.
Thank you so much. My pleasure to be here.
And it's great having you. So tell us a little bit about yourself. You have had an incredible amount of experience and a variety of roles in education. Can you tell our audience a little bit about yourself and your involvement in the education system?
Yes, I have about 40 plus years of credit in education. I've served as a teacher. I've taught core subjects, the fine arts, theater and dance, speech, communications. I've taught kindergarten through 12th grade, community college, and college. And I also served as a principal. I've been a principal in a juvenile prison as well as a principal in a mental health residential facility. At one point, while working on my doctorate, I took a job as a parapro and substitute in school, some other things to, you know, to supplement the income. So I've found that having that background, having been in the classroom, having worked as a substitute, worked as a paraprofessional, worked as a core content teacher, worked as a fine arts teacher, and I've also worked in special education, serving the gifted students in reading and in English. I find that having those different windows and those different lens allow me to see things from different perspectives. And then having walked in the principal's shoes, assistant principal's shoes, it gives me a chance to see that view as well.
Wow, that's amazing, the plethora of experience that you've had and the wide range. Now, your company, Collaborative Educational Supportive Services, offers a holistic approach to education. Can you explain what that means and how the organization achieves that goal?
Yes, I think the holistic, because I call us and we are triune beings, we are spirit, soul, and body, that all three are necessary in order for us to really educate someone. For instance, there's a part of me that needs to express itself through movement, through my body. There's a part of me, when you tap into my limbic system and my emotional arena, there's a part of me with a spiritual being, and because of, it could be your culture, it could be your religious beliefs. So if I'm going to try to educate a child, I need to understand that child's culture. I need to understand where that child is coming from, the environment they live in, and all the other environments that impact who he or she is. Then by doing that, I'm able then to assess what are your needs and then to design what is appropriate for you in the specific setting. For instance, I worked with a company. They contracted me to help with some kids that were struggling in school, some kids that were moving about. And what I found was that there had to be a period of education for the teacher to understand this child, because the teacher was making assumptions about the child. It was not true, and the child's parent. And because I understood the culture, understanding that that particular child had been reared in the South, had been reared in a certain environment, what you're seeing as opposition really is not. It's the child being inquisitive and wanting to know what's going on because I don't understand.
Yeah, and I really like that idea of the holistic approach because, there's more to a person, any person, than just what you see on the surface. And so getting to know the inner person is really important, and all facets of, that are included in that. You do a lot of work with the arts. Yes. And so can you explain how the arts help with learning and healing?
Okay, I like to say I use the arts in education. I use the arts for healing. I use the arts in ministry as well, if you talk about the three veins in which I use it. First of all, I think I discovered when I was a student myself that I learned differently. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, I thought something was wrong with me. Here I was. Mom put me in school a year early. Won't talk about that. And then they tell me in second grade, the teacher said, I want to skip her to the fourth grade. So I was a student who I learned differently, I learned quickly, I processed information, but I thought something was wrong with me. And it allowed me to have a complex about myself. For instance, I loved algebra. It was my favorite subject. And I got excited doing homework. I came to class. I said, teacher, look, I found the answer faster by doing it this way. She looked at it and said, do it the way I told you to do it. Mm-hmm. And I walked away like, why wouldn't you want to know there's another way to get the answer and it's still the correct answer? But she was, and that was a doorway for me to understand how sometimes we hold people to where we are rather than her saying, well, show me. Let me understand what you found. So I said, okay, I got you. So at home, I would do it my way, do it quickly, plug it into her little system so I can go out and play.
Right.
So having said that, that fueled the part inside of me that says I thought something was wrong with me. And it wasn't until I became a teacher, fast forward, and started taking workshops about learning styles. And when I learned about the multiple intelligences by Howard Gardner, got a chance to meet him while working on my dissertation, because my dissertation is about using the arts and using professional teachers as artists. I'm sorry, using artists, professional artists as teachers mm-hmm. with at-risk youth. That's my dissertation. So the multiple intelligences theory says that we each have multiple intelligences. And so a part of what I do is assessments, learning style, multiple intelligence inventory to see how this child learns. And then the arts are critical because the arts, for instance, in counseling, we say talk therapy. Children say, no. Okay. And so, but if I can use the arts as experientials and to tap in their limbic system where those memories are stored, where the emotions center here, and then we can process it later after we've done some activities, I found that they are much more conducive to your sessions and to learning. And interestingly enough, when I was studying to be a professional actor in college, I received my greatest healings through the exercises, through emotional recall, through some other things that we did. So that kind of fueled my interest and desire in using the arts. And I found that when I was teaching English, you and I talked about our similarities in that you also taught English in high school for a series of time. I did. And so thinking about, how do students learn, thinking about the arts and the impact that can have, I developed, and this is back in the 90s, I developed, it was English Through the Arts course of study. They hated, I had seniors, they hated British literature, mm-hmm. they hated research. So what I did was incorporate the arts, allowed each to research an area they're interested in. We still went through a rubric, we still had the things that they had to learn, but we found that when they sang about Tessa the D'Urberville and put it into a jazz tune, but able to show me they understood the sequence of events, they understood a lot of other things we were teaching. I won't get too much in depth with that. But it's been through my own history and my own experiences that I saw the arts were very powerful. For instance, when I left undergrad, my first job was in a music therapy program. This is in the 70s. And my supervisor looked at me and said, why don't you develop a dance and drama therapy program? And we're talking about the 70s, all right? And so I had background in psychology. I had background in the arts. And so I just went into graduate library. I pulled some things down. I created some sessions. And I went in. I started teaching. And the patients turned around so much. The psychiatrists and the medical doctors called me in their office and said, what are you doing? What are you doing with these patients? And I shared some of the things we were doing. Again, the arts, education, and healing.
Wow. And that, yeah, the 70s, really ahead of the times, because now I think music and art therapy is more common and prevalent. But at the time, you were probably one of the first to even think of that idea, right? Or to implement it,
Well, the dance and drama therapy, music therapy had been there for a while.
I see.
Gradually, and you had psychodrama, some other things that came along.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. Back then, when I was trying to find information to create, it wasn't there as much. So I had to create it myself. And then that became a tool for how I use the arts today.
Yeah, incredible. Let's talk a little bit about the at-risk populations that you work with. What initiatives or factors do you think contribute the most to student success, specifically for those students who are at risk?
Okay, first of all, I think that you have to develop a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not going to address initiative like all different kinds of educational things that are out there, but in order to be successful, this is my opinion from my work with students, having worked with kids in mental institutions, having worked with kids in the prison system, having worked with kids that are transitioning out of prison, having worked with kids, you know, I've targeted certain neighborhoods, even in my outreach, to go to where kids are most disenfranchised. So having worked with them, number one, relationship. Mm-hmm. I found even in the prison, if I develop a relationship with them, it opened a door for them to receive from me. You know, and secondly, acknowledge that we're different. I'm so glad that our culture now is beginning to celebrate differences. Come on now.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the nature, if you look at the flowers, you look at the trees, they're different. And so somehow, historically, we've always shunned certain people. You don't look the way I do. You don't sound like I do. You don't talk like I do. And so we've created this barrier to education. So much with what we call, instead of saying at-risk children, which is the children in at-risk environments, at-risk situations, you know. So I found that if I develop a relationship, if I also found out how does this child best learn and connect. I had a young guy I was working with, and he was very closed off. Matter of fact, this is through counseling, and matter of fact, he would hide under a blanket, you know. And I found that he had a pet rooster. And
wow.
So, you know, I said, okay, he told me the rooster's name. I won't give it in case, you know, that someone's listening. But the whole point was just understanding. I said, tell me about that rooster. And the more he talked about the rooster, I'm learning about the child.
Yeah.
And so at times in session, if we got a little hairy, we talk about a little rooster. And as a matter of fact, because of that, he started opening up more. So that's why I really love the learning style. I really love the multiple intelligence, but also love other ways of assessing students. That's one of my pet peeves, because in developing the learning through the arts, you have to determine performance-based, project-based. You still can do criterion reference. You still can do norm reference. But if we're not careful, we'll stick kids in one little box and say, this is a box. And I think Howard Gardner talked about that, how we're the logical, mathematical, and verbal linguistic. We get stuck with your math and your science scores and don't stop and think there are other ways students are intelligent. So when working with those populations, developing a relationship, understanding that they're different, and then meeting them where they are. And I think sometimes we try to take people too fast to where we want them to go instead of helping them discover where they need to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can certainly see how the arts would only help a teacher or a counselor, whoever is working with the student, be able to grow that relationship in order to help the student. What has been the most impactful experience that you've had in the education world?
Wow. As I've shared, you know, I taught elementary, middle school, high school, community college, and college. My favorite, most favorite job ever, ever, ever in education was being a principal in a juvenile prison. That to me was most meaningful because we saw kids that had been disenfranchised. We saw kids that were marginalized. We saw kids who were in environments that they could not control in many cases. And when they came to our school, it was very difficult to even find their attendance and their scores and their grades from school. Some of them had bounced from school to school to score to score. But I tell you, what an awesome team we had. A team of a guidance counselor, a special education instructor. It was just a bunch of people, principal, assistant principal, education liaison. We would come together. We would take the record and piece it together and then talk about who this child is and bring the child in and talk to the child. And one of the things I liked when I first got hired and I was hired as assistant principal, they told me choose 5 people to mentor. And I choose the 5 students I found in the hallway the most kicked out of class. And so one of the things I did there was to meet with the child, and we looked at their records, and we talked about it. But then the child and I came up with a plan, and we were talking real talk, you know. And so out of that, they became invested in their own education. So I guess that's probably the most meaningful, because I saw the most growth in students and my staff and our team, how we saw students that graduated, that would have never graduated, passing the GED who have never done it, and running down the hallway saying, hey, hey. But the saddest thing, and that's the reason I developed my business, saddest thing is I saw a boy also celebrate coming back. I'm back. I said, what? And that's a segue into why I created Collaborative Education Supportive Services. At the mental institution, a young lady jumped out of the moving car the third time they tried to take her away from our program. And she said, I want to go to school there. She said, why can't I live out here but go to school there? So I said to myself, there's something missing in our public schools. So in other school systems, not just public, but the others as well. So that's why I found that to be the most meaningful and have the most impact on me, because I saw the most impact on them.
And yeah, talk a little bit more about your business and what were the kind of initial stages of it? How did it start? What sorts of services were you providing initially compared to what you're providing now?
That's a very good question. Well, initially, my heart desire, because I made a bookmark. When I saw that child celebrate, when I saw another young boy in the mental institution, he was so smart, so gifted. And when I was hired, I had to become that change agent. Because the people there, the curriculum was outdated, they didn't have computers, a bunch of stuff that they told me later that my staff who had been loafers became gophers. But I had to sit down and we had to talk about what are we doing with these kids. And we had to look at our comprehensive school improvement plan, how we're going to improve our services. So having done that and seeing this little boy and he was laying on the desk sleeping, and I said, The teacher was complaining, and I said, that boy's smart. I bet she's very smart. Gifted. Mm-hmm. Wasn't challenging enough. So anyway, because I saw the gaps in education, I decided when I get out, when I finish doing my little tenure, I'm going to develop a program to be an education liaison for students and to advocate for students who may be transitioning from the penal institution, trying to get back into the public schools, or students who are struggling in their classrooms. And because I didn't tell you, but as a teacher, they gave me their worst students. I know because the other teachers said, you have who? Girl, I had him, you know. And I realized that they were giving me all this. I was a new teacher. They gave me the students the others couldn't handle. Mm-hmm. And so I had to cut my teeth on learning how to challenge them, how to teach them. And that is a whole story by itself, to be able to see kids who challenged me on the book I was using. Hey, excuse me. They said, she's new. She doesn't know. Miss So-and-so, you have the wrong book. They're talking about English textbook. Because I use the very same one that the gifted students use. I said, no, I don't. And they start whispering, she didn't hear you, man. Tell again. Excuse me. You have the wrong book, because I see Cha-Cha's name in here, and he was in this level of English, and we're in this level. I smiled. No, I don't. But what I had to do was scaffold. I had to get strategies. So by mid-year, those kids were caught up with the other students on the other level. So that's why I said in my business I wanted to help students that were struggling. Even as a therapist, they gave me their worst clients. Came to my face, laughed at me, and told me, gave you Mr. Cha-Cha. So having done that, the first place I started, I was hired to help kids that were transitioning out of PYC at Pueblo. Okay. And so as a result of that, I began to help them get back in schools, meet with the parents, meet with the teachers, sometime observe class and give them strategies, give the teacher strategies, give the parents strategies to help the kids succeed. And then I move forward to now we're doing, I did workshops for parents, grandparents, those who wanted to learn how to advocate for their students, and also those that didn't understand IEPs and the RTI process. We did that. And so the other part of it is counseling. I use the arts with small care healing groups, and that's a story by itself.
Wow, amazing. Well, we are about out of time, but I know you have, you know, you have many books that you've authored, and I'm sure people can find out more on your website. So what is your website? Where can people find you if they're interested in learning more?
My website is drmargaretbwright.com.
Okay.
drmargaretbwright.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure meeting you and learning more about your organization and what you do.
Well, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it.
This has been The Huntington Way. My name is Pearl Sun and Shine, and we'll catch you next time.